live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect. A time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
We are experiencing probably some of the best fall weather we have in many, many years. In any event, we're also have been dodging the hurricanes, but they seem to be affecting some of the folks up in the East Coast, probably including my guest today. So we're going to have a good time. We're going to talk a little bit about our early American ancestors and anything else you want to talk about. My guest today is David Lambert. He is the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogy Society. And David comes with us with many, many years of experience, and especially in the type of research many of you probably are more interested in, and that is those who descend from probably some of our early pilgrims and Mayflower descendants, as well as the whole really New England area, which is where almost all of our ancestors in this country came from. So, David, welcome. Hey, and were you affected by the hurricanes this season?
Well, I'd say a little bit, mostly wind and rain, down branches here and there, but nothing substantial. The true nor'easters really haven't poured into us, or hurricanes, and hopefully they'll still steer clear from us a little bit. What we were supposed to get about a couple of weeks back went out to sea, really. So,
well, good for you.
Yes.
Those of us down here on the Third Coast, we're really glad to see that nothing made it into the Gulf for a change.
Oh, probably, with everything going on in the Gulf, the last thing you need is Mother Nature to whip up something for you as well.
There you go. So we've had a wonderful summer and beautiful fall, and hopefully we'll get through the hurricane season with no events. How would that, wouldn't that be nice?
Very nice.
David, you started your genealogy when you were really young, weren't you? Didn't you?
Yeah, I was 7 years old, actually. What basically happened was I was home from school, and a book that my uncle had borrowed from my grandmother, who lived with us, he returned it after years of borrowing it, and it was a genealogy of her father. Well, I was very intrigued when he came in. He handed me this heavy old book, and sticking out of it was a metal photograph, and I took the photograph very curious what this was, thinking it was a bookmark or something. And I asked my grandmother, I said, "Who is this?" It was a photograph, a tintype. And she said, "Oh, this is my father." And I was, intrigued the idea because, for a 7-year-old to think that his 80-year-old grandmother was young enough to have parents, let alone what's this photograph on metal. And then she opened up the book and she said, "This is where my father and mother are, and this is my two older sisters." And I thought to myself, "Oh, that's kind of interesting." I went on my way, and she goes, "By the way, David, my father was on a whaling ship." She had known that recently in school we were learning about a kid's version of Moby Dick, and it caught my attention. I'm like, "He was in a whaling ship?" And I was all curious, and I said, "Well, Nana," I said, "why aren't you in this book?" She goes, "I had not been born yet." And I thought, the great idea, well, why don't we update it, And that's when I started working on it, and 4 decades later, I'm still working on it. My family tree. It's a never-ending process, as you well know. Yeah, so I've been doing genealogy for a fair amount of my life, and I took on the interest of local history, which kind of spurred off of it, and I joined our local historical society when I was 10, and now I'm a former board member and currently the vice president. So whereas I have no roots in Stoughton, my hometown, I've sort of adopted the community. I've written 3 books on the subject and transcribed vital records, church records, cemeteries, and whatnot, so other people can get the benefit of, research. And hopefully the same thing will be done in kind for the towns my ancestors lived in that I don't have a chance to visit so much.
So let's talk a little bit about where, the organization that you are currently working for and that you've been with since, 1993, I think?
That's correct, yeah. It's the New England Historic Genealogical Society, located in Boston at 99 Newbury Street. We are the oldest genealogical organization in the world. We have over 26,000 members, and on our website, AmericanAncestors.org, you can find out about a lot of the things that we have currently going on, as well as databases we have. But I also suggest people to come and visit our research center, which is one of the best in the world. And it's not just for New England, but does help out with people that are having ancestors who pass through New England, or even if you don't have ancestors from New England, you have some genealogical brick wall you're trying to work on, stop by, because we have the resources to help you, even if it's in a different country. So it's a great place.
Let's talk a little bit about the new website, because this just launched, about a month ago or so?
That's correct, yeah. AmericanAncestors.org. Our website formerly was New England Ancestors.org, and we've merged and brought across all of our data and the research experience and comments from researchers have been very positive. And one of the things that's really nice about the new website, we've consolidated the search function, so you don't have to search different databases every time you want to find an ancestor. It's actually consolidated down to one search engine, which makes life a lot easier for researchers, and it spans all the thousands of databases we have here.
Well, you know, I joined about a year and a half ago, or maybe a year ago, or I can't remember, because I was actually working on a case for a client, and we ended up in Connecticut, and I actually was able to find exactly what we were looking for through the website. So, as most of my listeners know, that my ancestors didn't come over here until probably the mid to late 1800s. So I don't normally haven't had a whole lot of experience in the kind of research that you do, obviously, because that hasn't been where my personal research had been up to this time. But I will tell you that if you are looking in that particular general area and are really trying to work your ancestors back, to when they first stepped foot on this land, this is probably one of the first places to go.
Well, you know, one of the things a lot of people have said, you know, are we just purely New England? And, I mean, our publications that we have on our website now include the Virginia Genealogist, for instance, and obviously Virginia being settled even before New England with colonists back to the time of Jamestown, even before. This scholarly journal is something that we've added. So I think a lot of times people have thought, well, if I don't have ancestors from New England, what benefit would it be for me? Now, I can speak from personal example. 20 years ago, before I was even working there, I would go to NEHGS and visit and use their Canadian resources. Long before Ancestry.com launched censuses online or put anything, actually, for that matter, if there was anything online to search, I would actually use the microfilm. And we have things for Atlantic Canada, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, PEI, and a substantial collection for Quebec, that a lot of people had migrated through Canada and came down, like my family did. My earliest New Englander is from 1629. My latest is my grandparents from New Brunswick in 1923. So wow. I was able to find a great deal of 19th and 20th century information, not having anything to do with New England, but Canadian, because of our focus has always been on trying to look outside of New England.
Now, your role as the chief genealogist, you answer questions that people have. And, in fact, while I bring that up, if anybody in our audience has any questions that they would like to pose to David, we will be taking your calls. And the number is 888-815-9756. So you do a lot of that kind of stuff, too, don't you?
Exactly. Well, it started back in I would say December of 2004, when our president, D. Brenton Simons, came up to me and asked me if I wanted to change my job around a little bit. I had been working reference for a number of years in our microtext floor, which is where all our microfilm and microfiche were, and he wanted me to be able to reach out to the 26,000-plus members. And what my title isn't exactly chief genealogist. It's the online genealogist.
Okay.
I generally handle the questions that come in that are people are looking for genealogical advice. So if you're stuck with a brick wall, I can give you some suggestions. Or better yet, if you have a question, it might not even relate to a database that we have or a resource, but I will go and try to find that source for you, essentially becoming your virtual reference librarian, if you will, that you can't set foot at our research center at 99 Newbury Street in Boston, but you can actually ask me a question and get that sort of experience that way. We also have a page on Facebook as well, and I will handle answering questions via that medium as well. It's very rewarding because from what I've found, that the questions are going to vary from, you know, looking for something like a lost schoolmate from 25 years ago to somebody looking for their royal line or trying to get deeper into their DNA research, which is a whole other fascinating aspect that genealogy has spun off on.
Sure. So in any event, that's a lot of work.
It is. And it is just me. So one of the things that occasionally happen is that I have to direct questions that are more like, please send me everything you have on Henry Anderson, who lived in Boston in the 1800s. It's like, okay, well, I can offer you advice on how to find Henry through city directories or vital records that we might have online, or, you know, explain to you where to get records from deeds or probate, et cetera, or newspapers. But I can't stop and do the research for you. And one of the things that we have is a research service. And under the website, you can actually hire the experts. And there's a rate for members and a rate for non-members that can actually have hourly research done. And for people who can't come into Boston to do the research, or perhaps the database isn't online that's going to answer it for you, and it has to do the old-fashioned researching through the Registry of Deeds records or going to the probate court or looking through newspaper reels, we can do that for you. It's just that, unfortunately, sometimes I would say probably maybe 10% of my questions, 15% occasionally, will be someone just going to ask me to do the research for them for free. And unfortunately, because we have 26,000-plus members, and I'm also getting questions from non-members as well, that we just can't stop and answer all of them. In my good heart of being a kind and generous genealogist can only extend so far without having to clone myself, I would say.
I certainly understand. You know, one of the things I've been doing since, you know, my departure from Jewish Gen has been doing research. So yeah, it's kind of a different twist to do research and help others do their own research than it is to do your own research. But, you know, most people don't know how to start, or B, have brick walled, or C, don't want to do it, but, you know, do want to start to learn a little bit about their ancestry. I mean, you can probably, probably will agree with me, actually, that, you know, when you start delving into your ancestry, you really start learning a whole lot about yourself.
Oh, very much so. Very much.
And a whole lot about your parents and why they are who they are, and maybe why they did some of the things that they did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a healing process, I think, that takes place in a lot of the relationships that we have with our families. Mm-hmm. As well as, you know, the healing of, you know, those that have gone before us and who are departed, that, you know, really, you know, helps us better understand, you know, the times they were living in and really why some of the actions that they did that we may harbor some resentment, you know, they did because that was all they had to work with.
Well, I mean, both my parents had me late in life. I'm in my 40s. My parents are both passed, and they would be children of the Great Depression. My father would be 85. My mother would be 80. And my dad, who had a very hard life during the Great Depression, living in the city and whatnot, very much respected, once he came out to the suburbs, land. And here's a kid that grew up and probably had a 12-foot square plot of dirt or grass behind his house that he lived. And when he moved out here, you know, we'd make gardens or plant flowers and trees. And I never could understand what the great – it's like, well, I always knew they were here. But for my father, he never had the experience of having all of this, you know, vegetation growing around. So I can understand his need for that, and made me gain a bit of appreciation for what he had growing up, because he took me to East Boston where he grew up and showed me some of these places. And I could – see where it would be difficult living in sort of the urban jungle and moving out to some place where you can actually grow flowers and grass.
Well, you know, and it's true. David, we have our first caller. We're going to take it. It's Julie from Wisconsin on line two.
Okay.
Hi, Julie.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Do you have a question for David?
Yes. He had mentioned that he can, or his, where he works, has access to records in Canada. And I was wondering how far back it goes in Canada.
Well, my question to you, Julie, is what province in Canada are you looking for? Because it's going to vary on each Canadian province.
Okay. That's a great question. I think it was around the Montreal area or Toronto that my grandmother came to.
Okay. Well, if it's when you said she came to from Toronto, did she arrive in the 19th century from Europe?
Yes, she did.
Okay. Do you know what province she came? Oh, not province, rather. What country she came from in England? Was it England, Ireland, or?
It was England. Yes. Yeah.
In England. Okay. My own great grandparents set sail from Southampton in 1911 and headed across and came into Canada. So one of the things that's available are the passenger lists. Starting in 1865, the Canadian Archives in Ottawa online has passenger lists that you can search that have the Canadian migration. So if it's post-1860s, you're probably in good shape that you could probably find the vessel that they arrived on. Then online, for free from FamilySearch.org, is the 1881 Canadian Census. And so that's one thing that you can point to. I'm trying to give you some resources outside of leaving Wisconsin and coming to Boston to do the research. For Ontario, vital statistics do start in the late 1860s, so you should probably be able to find civil registration for birth, marriages, and deaths clear through to about the 1920s, I believe, is what they have opened up right now, at least for marriages and deaths. I think births are 100 years still. But you should probably be able to piece the family pretty much together. The 1901 and 1911 census for Canada is on automatedgenealogy.com, where volunteers have indexed all of the Canadian 1901 and 1911 census. So that should help you for Ontario. And for Quebec, at NEHDS, we have over 2,000 rolls of microfilm alone for Quebec churches, and that includes Catholic and non-Catholic, which is part of what the Drouin collection.
That's a great start. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
You're quite welcome.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So that's the kind of thing that you do. And
that's exactly it. My phone will ring or my email, or better yet, people who have not embraced the Internet still sending letters conventionally in an envelope with a stamp. I reply back to them as well. And that's the thing I try to hope is to get the guidance that they need so they don't think it's a brick wall, but it's something that they can actually conquer. It's I find that a lot of times people say when their genealogy is done, I don't think it's a matter of being done, as in they found the last ancestor they found in any record in a country. It's that they're done putting effort into something because it's become frustrating. So I try to circumvent that by saying, how far back can you go on this line? Or where is your stumbling blocks? And then it opens up that they're not really done, but they just need some new guidance on which way to go.
Exactly. And, you know, and too, and I guess you know this probably better than I, that, you know, you get to a certain point and trying to prove things get very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
You know, and a lot of times, too, and I don't I've worked a couple of Mayflower lines for clients, and, you know, we get back to a certain point, and we have some, you know, intermarriage with some Indians, and, you know, there's really no proof anywhere of what one of the wives' last names were, and, you know, what do you do? I mean, what do you recommend to people when you get to that point? I mean,
I can speak to Native American pretty much. I'm actually a tribal historian for the Massachusetts Ponkapog Indians, which are the praying Indians that were formed after John Elliott started putting the Indians in, I would say, modern-day Indian reservations. They were called praying towns back then. And one of the things that I try to tell people is that you have to look at the general population was not actually embracing Native Americans as potential spouses until the 19th century. There's a lot of great myths and family trees where people will say that in the 1600s, their ancestor married an Indian princess, and, you know, it doesn't pan out. It turns out that it's a European lady who does not have a last name. There's a great story that's been debunked over the years of a pilgrim, not pilgrim, but a Cape Cod family, where someone married Mary Iannone, and they're connecting her with the name Iannone as a great sachem of Cape Cod off the Wampanoag Indians. And it turns out that her last name is probably not Iannone, but Enos, and it was just misspelled because the colonial fathers did not look and even embrace the idea that Native Americans would be intermarrying with the colonists. So you start to see it in the late 1700s, but it's more so African-American and Native American. So the one thing that people can do now is through DNA, you can have what's called an admixture test. And the admixture test will actually determine if you have any Asiatic markers, which would be present for Native American, unless, of course, you have some recent Japanese, Korean, or Chinese, or some Asian ancestry. Some small marker that shows up it is Asiatic will probably, oh, it's not going to tell you what tribe you're associated with, but at least it will confirm your story. I had the same story in my family tree. My great-grandmother said that we had some Native American in the blood, and this person had high cheekbones and their darker skin. When I had my full sequence of my DNA search, there was nothing Asiatic. It was purely white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, 100% white European. And so sometimes the DNA can debunk it, or the research can.
Exactly. And you know, that's one of the things that I recommend to a lot of clients is, you know, to go ahead and you know, if you're really serious about doing your genealogy and wanting to know where you came from and, and also, too, your heritage, that DNA testing is probably, you know, one of the first places to start. What about the people that, you know, want to prove that they have royal blood?
Well, that isn't as difficult, because what you need to basically do is find that you have a colonist that has a royal line. And a great deal of the work by Gary Boyd Roberts, who's one of the senior research scholars, has been associated with NEHTS since 1974. He's currently retired, but still is a scholar emeritus at the organization. He has put out a book, 600 Royal Descents of Colonists, and this book outlines people who have a descent from, say, Edward the First, or from Charlemagne, or for some royal line that is proven. One of the biggest problems we have with colonial research is we know a lot of our ancestors were living here, say, by the 1630s because they purchased land or something, but we don't know what village they came from in England because of the lack of passenger lists. So it's hard to say your John Johnson is related to which Johnson in England unless you find a connecting document. And then often that is a probate record back in England, using that as an example, that connects your ancestor living in New England, using that as another place, that might show, all right, he's from the village near Salisbury, England, and now you can get into the church records. And beyond that, it's a matter of finding that he might have been a minister, as some of them were, and that they had a higher standing in their family, that their ancestor may have been a baron or lower gentry, and then further back you go, you find that maybe not in the 1500s or the 1600s, but in the 1300s or the 1400s, their ancestor was a knight or was an illegitimate child of a king. I mean, so the Royal Bastard Society is something that a lot of people have joined because it's not a legitimate line to the throne, but an actually illegitimate line to the throne.
What? I don't think I'd ever heard of that one.
Yeah, that's actually an organization, the Royal Bastard Society. And there's also others that people can join, like the Order of Charlemagne, which are the descendants of Charlemagne. And once you get back into European genealogy, back into the 14 and 1500s, you might find that you do have a royal line. There's probably a good chance that Charlemagne fits into your family tree because of the length of time that he lived. With the idea of the two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, when you get back that far, you're dealing with tens to thousands of potential ancestors. So you might have royal blood and never be able to find it. But if you do find that you have somebody who's already been researched, it's a fun connection. I have probably about three or four royal lines back to Edward I. And it's fun to know that I can trace my ancestors back that far, but I'm just as interested in the peasant farmer as I am with the notable. But it makes it for fun talk around the dinner table for those non-genealogists in your family when you can tell them that they're related to Eleanor of Aquitaine or something like that.
Right. I want to give out the number again. This is a real opportunity, folks, if you have any questions, to give us a call and ask David. The phone number is 888-815-9756. You know, one of the things that probably is one of my biggest pet peeves, and I'm sure probably yours too, is the, you know, we have situations now since online genealogy has pretty much taken off where, you know, people have put their online trees online in various sources, including Ancestry.com is one, and they're all wrong. And then people, you know, copy it and they don't do their research. And so you have now maybe one wrong line that is now propagated to 10 wrong lines. And then somebody comes on new and, you know, they say, oh, I'll just copy this. This looks good. And so, you know, a lot of work that I do, David, I'm sure you do too, is untangling some of those webs that, have been created because there was one wrong tree.
Exactly. I mean, and that's really the joy of the internet is reconnecting with people, distant cousins that you may not know you have from, you know, a common ancestor from 100, 200 years ago, and sharing information. But if you're very new with genealogy, the idea of not knowing what's right and wrong could be that, well, it must be right. It's on the internet. It's sort of like the same adage from before the internet. Well, it's in print. It has to be correct. And the internet has the capability now of you could hyperlink your original primary source from any statement that you make. So if you wanted to say that your ancestor was born in 1740 in Stoughton, Massachusetts, you can be able to ideally get a microfilm image of the actual record, scan it, put it up online, and there's no doubt. But when you put a lot of circa dates or there are even misconnected lines that have Mayflower passengers born in the 1500s in Massachusetts. Last time I checked, the Wampanoag Indians and the Mayflower were not the same. So this is the type of thing that we don't try to, like, scold people. We just try to, you know, educate them the fact of, okay, you have this information on the internet. You don't have any primary sources or even secondary sources listed on this person's webpage that they've thrown up. You want to ask them, contact the webmaster and say, what's your source? Maybe you just didn't have time to put it in the coding of the web page. Or better yet, reinvestigate the source yourself. Print it off. Go to some place like NEHDS or the Family History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah, or, you know, go to the courthouse and prove that fact is correct. I've had many, I shouldn't say arguments, but I've been critical doing my own research. I go online and someone has a statement. I'm like, well, how do you know who the parents are? For instance, one of the lines I work on is the last name Poor. And about 40 years ago, somebody submitted to the Family History Library a group chart that said Daniel Poor, born in 1620, was the son of Mr. Poor, and Mr. Daniel Poor, and Mrs. Daniel Poor. Well, that isn't backed up by any record at all. It's that, assuming that their father must have had the same name as the child. And so that has recopied itself numerous times on many websites, or it's gone into print even occasionally, which is surprising, with incorrect facts. And I always like to try to say, all right, I like where you're going with this, but show me your evidence. And a lot of times people can't. They say, well, I found it online at blankety blank, or I found this book that has this this story on it, and sometimes the book isn't worth the weight of the paper it's printed on. And that's the hard facts we occasionally have to tell people. And when they come to our programs, like next weekend, we have a fall research getaway. And what that's going to consist of is helping people trace their family trees using records at our organization and our research center. But I have seen printouts from the internet or that don't have any sources. And what I try to help people with is finding what those sources are or debunking the fact that, well, that is probably incorrect, and you might want to tell the person online to take it down. And
right. You try to get that to happen.
Right. Well, genealogy programs having the ability of posting up data has made it a little more difficult, too, because what happened is you can actually just take your data that you've inputted into whatever genealogy program you use and then just dump it as an online HTML page. Makes it hard because now you might have a good theory that you've never checked out, like maybe grandma was born in Tipperary, Ireland, but you just think that because it's oral tradition. Fine, put in your source. This fact is from oral tradition in the family. At least you're substantiating where it's coming from. And then as myself, as a genealogist who's now surfing the net, finds this relative that you have claimed to be from Tipperary, Ireland, I know that your fact isn't from a passenger list or baptism record. It's from family story. And, you know, they are worth and sometimes are very valuable to keep in our research notes. But it's not the hard fact evidence that's going to prove it 100%. And just you use it as a stepping stone.
Exactly. I mean, I'm working with a client who is trying to trace their descent from King Edward IV through a daughter by the name of Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this Margaret married to John Watson. Well, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist. And, I mean, the first thing I did is I went to Wikipedia and I just started looking up, you know, King Edward IV, and he had a daughter by the name of Margaret. She just died as an infant. So, you know,
It's interesting that a lot of times people with daughters, that is, they don't have the person married off, or there's no record of her death. So right away, she becomes a hanging branch that they can connect to their own family tree because this just fits. Because we know that this ancestor's name was Margaret. She has to be Margaret, the daughter of the king, or through another line or something like that.
And, and there are eight people that had this connection, and I wrote all eight of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've told them, I said, you know, please show me, you know, if where there would be, another daughter by the name of Margaret. There could be. Because a lot of times they named their children after a child that had deceased as an infant. But I couldn't find it. But, most of them have thanked me. I haven't looked to see if they've removed that link from their trees. But, it does get a little disconcerting. And, the key, and as I see it, David, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, using online trees as a guide is great. I mean, you know, if you can find a tree and you can trace it back and use it as a template, more or less, to work your family, and then you really do need to document your sources and prove or disprove the theory that you've copied down as your guide. And that brings me to something too. And let's talk about sources and primary sources, secondary sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing about genealogy is maybe there is no birth record or no baptism record out there for your ancestor. But the question is, what can you get that might be the closest source? Like with vital records as a primary source, a lot of times the town clerk's records don't exist. Turn to the church records. See if those are an alternative. Have you found that to be the case in your research? The church records can often fill in the blanks, if you will?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Basically when I guide my clients, I the first thing I tell them to do is to do the census work and let's, you know, see if we can connect. And up until 1840, we can, pretty much get a family group pulled together. And then we have to start working the hard stuff, which is what I call it, and that's the vital records and all those other sources that are sometimes very easily attainable and sometimes not.
True. And one of the things that I hate to see people discourage that, well, there is no birth record. I'll give you an example. My own ancestor, my great-grandfather was born in 1843, somewhere in Nova Scotia. And for years, I scoured all of the vital records. Nova Scotia is very difficult because they don't have vital statistics until birth until 1864. And then they stopped them in 77. There was no census in the 1840s. The census of 51 is incomplete. the census that first names children is 1871. By then, he's an adult and already out there. How I found it after 20 years of research was adopting the surname for all of Nova Scotia, the last name of Lambert, and piecing together and saying, nope, this family doesn't work. This family doesn't work. They have a child born in that decade that doesn't fit. I found it by finding a deed in Colchester County written on the deathbed of a man in Halifax County for land in Cumberland County, which named my great-grandfather as the heir and given to his son by love and affection by his father. And I would have never found the connection other than through that deed. There is no other primary source out there. So sometimes the primary isn't what you always think is a birth or a birth record or a baptism record, for instance. It sometimes is indirect evidence, maybe a guardianship and a court record that names, after someone died, he names the following people will be guardians of the following children.
So, you know, I had a similar situation with my family, even though they immigrated in about 1850 up through Mexico to New Orleans, mm-hmm. and over here to Texas, and I couldn't find them anywhere. And the name was Marcus McGill, M-I-G-E-L. They were Sephardic Jews, Spanish Jews,
mm-hmm.
and I started going through the deed records down in the Galveston courthouse. And lo and behold, one of the deed records said, Marcus McGill, alias Lewis Marcus. Once I got the Lewis Marcus, I was able to trace him back in the census records. I also found, I had heard that he fought in the Civil War, was able to find his Civil War information. So the you never know where you're going to find information. And the
exactly. I mean, like I said, the answer could be right around the corner. Or might be in a source that you're not aware of. One of the best things I tell people to do, a lot of times like when they're doing New York State records, they say, well, there are no vital records. Well, okay, have you looked at all of the church records? And sometimes they'll say, I'm looking for an ancestor that was born in this county in New York in 1811, but I don't know who his parents are. Well, my answer is, have you looked at the 1810 census, looked at all of the available people with that surname in that county and the neighboring counties. I always like to add that. And then see in the 1820 census if that person has children that fit into the range 5 to 10, male or female, and then go forward and look at deeds, look at probates, look at records like that, that can actually maybe solve the problem for you. And that's panned out and been very helpful to many people over the years.
That and also, you know, I mean, again, I have most of my ancestry is Jewish ancestry, so mm-hmm. it gets a little tougher than most. But, you know, the way that I was able to determine the town of origin of my family was working laterally across my great-grandfather's siblings, and it turned out that there was a Texas birth record for my great-grandfather's brother's daughter,
okay.
where it mentioned that her father was born in Simnas, Lithuania.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
So, you know, you know, one of the things that I try to tell my clients is, you know, we don't want to leave any stone unturned, and you don't want to spend hours and hours and hours either doing it yourself or hiring someone to do it and have, you know, the information sitting in a place that is fairly easily attainable.
Correct.
And so, you know, I prefer to, you know, let's exhaust what we can get quickly
mm-hmm.
and make sure that you know, we exhaust those before we try to do the other stuff because we just never know. And the clues are really exciting. I think, you know, you've got to have some sleuthing or interest in sleuthing because, you know, you really have to look at the records. A lot of people, and I'm sure you know this too, is they'll pull down a census link and never look at the census record.
Right.
And
Or never look at all the columns in the census. I give a lot of talks on military records, and one of the things in the Civil War, people don't realize that there was a clue in the 1910 and the 1930 census if your ancestor fought in the Civil War. The 1910 asks the person if they were in the Union or Confederate service The 1930 asks you what war you fought in. So if you have an ancestor that you suspect before even going online looking for military records, you could determine this by that and also the surviving 1890 special schedule to the census. Whereas the 1890 census was destroyed, the veteran schedule survives for the states Kansas through Wyoming. Unfortunately, the federal government in the 1940s thought it was a good idea, since the 1890 was gone, to throw out states A to I. A to W survive.
Crazy. Well, you know, Ireland was worse.
Oh, yeah. But with the troubles over in Ireland, you know, we lost many of the Protestant records, the early censuses, and what do survive from the 19th century, from what I understand, were actually out of the main archival area and in the reading room on the table at the time of the bombings occurred, and so they had not been reshelved back, and that's the only reason they have certain censuses from the 1830s and 1840s, is that one page. I wish it had paged earlier records for a lot of counties, but unfortunately those are the only ones that survive.
Right. So, you know, we do run into all these situations where, you know, and that's where, you know, David is, you know, if his expertise is, and those of us who are professional genealogists is, you know, if we don't know every answer, we certainly know where to look. But, you know, instead of, you know, spending hours and hours and hours barking up wrong trees, you know, the best thing to do is, you know, to look to see if the records of where you're going, where you want to look, exist.
Mm-hmm.
And where they would exist. You know, the Family History Library is probably one of the biggest sources of you know, U.S. and international records, obviously.
With over 2 million rolls of microfilm. And one of the things that we do every year at NEHGS is we lead a research tour out in the fall. I'll be there from October 30th to November 7th with our group of over, I believe, over 80 people right now that are
going
to go out there. And as you know, Salt Lake City, very wonderfully helpful, but it can be sensory overload. As it is for people who come to NEHGS with our collections, with the Salt Lake City with 2 million rolls of microfilm, where do I start? So we try to guide people. We have consultations with them all week, and we, you know, help them decipher the records or translate the records if need be, and make the experience less daunting.
That's exciting, because I've been to Salt Lake on many, many occasions, and it is and can be overwhelming. And, you know, the other thing too, David, you know, as far as your collections and pretty much the collections here in the United States, the real key to research is county.
Right.
Is it not?
Yeah, the county will, especially in New England, will aid you with the probates and the deeds of the court records, whereas the town may have had limited record keeping early on. If your ancestor owned land or was sued by a neighbor or died, even if they died intestate and had some property or something that was personal or real estate, there would be a county record for it. In New England, it's interesting because in Massachusetts, the town records are very wonderful, and vital records go back to the 1600s or the incorporation of many of the towns. But we're also lucky with Massachusetts that the state records, which is one of the large databases we have on American ancestors, is the birth, marriages, and deaths from 1841 to 1915 for Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the first state in the Union to require statewide registration of birth, marriages, and deaths. New Jersey was the next by the 1848, and after that you have other bigger states like New York doesn't start really to the 1880s, Pennsylvania not till about 1900. So in those other states, turning to county registrations of marriages sometimes will answer the question where the state archives or the state records might not do so.
Now, you have expertise in both African American and Native American genealogy.
Yes.
Any suggestions for people who, a lot of people want to try to prove IA, their Native American ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
And you made a comment earlier on that kind of triggered something, is the tie between African American and Native Americans going back many years. Is
very, very true. Very true. There was a lot of intermarriage and interrelations where it may have not been a formal marriage recorded, but there may have been an African-American and Native American. And you'll see that present in the DNA because the you might have a theory on your family that you're Swedish, for instance. I had a gal that was in my wedding, blonde hair, blue eyes, looked very Scandinavian. But when I was doing the research, I found in the 1860 census that her great-great-grandfather, third-great-grandfather, was mulatto. He was mulatto because his grandmother and grandfather were African-American and Native American. In fact, his ancestor had fought in the Revolutionary War and was an early proponent for African rights. And I wasn't sure how she would take this. Now, I knew she wasn't racist, but some people will take a look and say, well, I'm Native American. Well, then they find out that they have African-American, and that might be a surprise to them. She embraced it. She wanted to learn more about the culture. She wanted to know more. And an example of the same type of thing, a good colleague who worked at our organization thought for years that her family name was English, was a British name. Last name was Burgess. And it turned out that her grandfather, Max Burgess, nothing matched up for him in the World War I draft registrations. But I did find him when he matched in Dayton, Ohio, as Max Buchinski. He got married a second time. He had changed the surname from Buchinski to Burgess, gone from being Jewish to Episcopalian, and never told his children. I think his wife may have known but never revealed it. So the grandchildren had no idea, and I helped her find her Buchinski cousins down in Florida, and now she celebrates both holidays.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of mysteries. Yeah, I'm working a very interesting case right now. It's an Irish family, and we're trying to determine parentage of someone's father. And, you know, nothing matches. And in one census, he's, you know, mentioned as the godson of this particular individual. And then the next census, he's listed as brother.
Mm-hmm.
And of the son of the original person, and you know, we kind of think that this one individual actually, who he said was his brother, was actually his father.
Oh gosh!
And you know, these are stories, and you know, this fella's doing his research, and his father has now passed away, and. You know, it bothered his father all his life that he never could determine who his parents were.
Sure.
And the interesting thing, and this is, you know, one of the things, too, that people need to do is, you know, reach out to people who are researching the same families.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know what stories will pass down, you know, from one line that doesn't come down to yours. And we're trying to, you know, set up a phone call, but, you know, they've pretty much given us something to work with that, you know, he'd never heard before. So it's really, genealogy is just, it's records, it's really a puzzle. It's putting two and two together. It's using the skills that David has after these 40-odd years of doing research, you know, to really, you know, try to put your puzzles together.
It really is a never-ending story because a lot of people get frustrated, and what I've seen, that they can't find the story of their immigrant for whatever reason. The records may have been destroyed, you know, many years ago because of, you know, the pogroms or in the Holocaust or just by war in general. But I tell people to concentrate on the other end of the story, getting down all the detail on that immigrant. Every living descendant of that person, what are their stories? What are their traditions? What are their memories? And record that down. Because for a person who has New England roots to go back to the 1620s, I would love to know that immigrant experience. So get the stories from the child of the person who arrived at Ellis Island. You know, those are lost to me. But so they can enrich the future generations by preserving the history now. And that's why everyone's story is so important.
And I want to go back a little bit to this Native American, African American, mulatto, you know, people who look white and, you know, go back to some of the issues that we have in this country about racism and things like that, that, you know, at some point, we may not be who we think we are.
Exactly.
And,
they all came out of Africa. I mean, the DNA has proven it, and it's like some people will embrace genetic DNA information. Some people will take a look at it and not want to reveal what they found. It's intriguing. I mean, a lot of times I've had African-American colleagues who have done research, and they go to do their Y-DNA, which is their male line, and then they find out it's not African at all, it's white. And I have, you know, colleagues that have tried to embrace that, and they'll say, well, why is that the case? And if you know the history of slavery and unfortunately what's gone on for, you know, for all those centuries when slavery was present, the likelihood that the father of your slave ancestor may have been the slave master and gives you a totally different outlook on that. Henry Louis Gates himself had came across that research when he was doing his DNA, that he had the European connection. But the other thing about African-American research, I find it very valuable because it's now bringing African-American researchers closer connections to where there, if there is a European, as to, okay, well, what surname does this match up with? So where was this plantation? Who was the plantation owner? And finding matches in their DNA with someone who might be African-American currently versus somebody who has a longstanding old Southern family. A perfect example, Sally Hemings and the Jefferson DNA, how that's changed history.
Right.
And
you know, some of the stories, too, and I think the NBC series, Who Do You Think You Are, there were a couple, Emmett Smith, for example, and really portrayed how some of these types of things can, you know, really change, you know, over the course of the years. And that, again, you know, we're not who we think we are sometimes. So in any event, I think the, I'm getting a message that I'm having problems with my mic. Can you
hear me? Yeah, it's fading out a little bit, but I can still hear you. I was wondering if it was my connection, actually.
No,
you know, one of the things for me for healing purposes, I was a child who had older parents. I didn't really know my grandparents. I had the one grandmother alive by the time I was 10 when she died. My other was killed when I was 6. My grandfather's I never knew. So for genealogy, I found out who I was. My parents didn't have all the facts and figures, you know, the stories, but I wanted to know who my great-grandparents were, my great-great-grandparents, because I saw as a child doing genealogy that it allowed me to see where my family fit into world history as well as American history. And it was more enriching for me to know as a child what my past was.
And that brings me to another thing, because you started age 7, you said?
7 years old, right.
Okay. And I started when I was 35.
Okay.
Okay. And I'm a lot older than you. I'm in my 60s now.
Just a couple of years, I'm sure.
Right. you know, one of the things that has always bothered me is why kids are not introduced to this at your age rather than at my age.
You know, it's... The tough thing for me is that my parents had stories about their parents and some stories about their grandparents, but a lot of families just didn't talk about this. You know, the dinner table was talked about what you did today, not what you did long ago. I can tell you that I talked to some of my mother's older cousins to try to get some information on my grandmother's siblings and whatnot, and they said, we didn't talk about that sort of stuff in the past, and, you know, leave history alone. It's like... like makes me think there was a black sheep in the family I had to find.
Right. And then you know,
that sometimes is a reason. There's something they're trying to hide to protect, you know, future generations that maybe a child won't understand. But I think a general sense of what ethnicity you are or when your ancestors arrived or taking them to the cemeteries to see where their ancestors are buried so these people aren't forgotten forever, that's one of the greatest things I did with my wife's grandmother, who's now passed on, is I sat down with her and had her write the names on the back of over 500 photographs that after she passed away, when we inherited those, we know who they were. And these go back to the 1800s, that I don't even have that sort of resource in my family because nobody saved anything. I have very limited photographs of my great-grandparents. I have pictures of only three of them out of eight. The other ones, just nobody saved them.
Or they cut them in half.
Exactly. Or they're on the names of photographs that actually are tied into the genealogy of someone else, that you actually have a collection of family photos, and is it a relative? Is it a cousin? So it's very difficult knowing whether your ancestors' photographs you're staring at are yours or they're friends of your relatives. So please, if any of your listeners are doing anything on a rainy day, put names on the back of your photographs.
I am a guilty party.
We all are. Think of the digital age. We name a file. I mean, how are you writing on the back if you never print them out? And so, and it's very scary about technology. It's a wonderful thing we embrace, but what stories are we leaving for our descendants to unfold letters or postcards or photographs if we never print off the emails or we only send virtual postcards, we only keep digital pictures and don't back up the data to a new format? You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I thought I lost you for a second. The signal kind of faded out just a little bit.
Yeah, I must be having a few more technical problems here again. I'm going to raise up my volume a little bit, but it doesn't seem to be doing a whole lot.
One of the things I'd like to invite your callers or your listeners, if they would like to get a hold of me, they can reach me through AmericanAncestors.org, or they can feel free to send me a question or a query if maybe they were too shy to pick up the phone and call to onlinegenealogist@nehgs.org. I'd be glad to entertain and help anybody that has some needs.
That's great. And anything else you want to mention about the new website? Before I think we're going to get a queue here that we're going to have to end soon. So,
okay. Well, I invite them, again, to go to AmericanAncestors.org and look at our website. You can sign up and view some of the databases without even having to be a member, and you can create your own login and account. So that allows you to ask questions of me, the online genealogist, or you might even be able to network with other genealogists that are working around the country on a similar problem or a similar surname, because you can create a little page that says, I'm interested in families from Mansfield, Massachusetts, or my interest is Polish genealogy. And it will allow you to network with other people without even having to lay down any money to join. And if you do decide to join AmericanAncestors.org, keep in mind that we're not just a website. We're a physical library you can visit. We have publications that we mail out as part of your membership, and you can talk to a person like myself and get some genealogical guidance versus have to deal with just having answers on technical support issues you might have getting to the database. I can answer technical support questions on your ancestry.
There you go.
And I would also welcome people, if they ever do make it into Boston, to come and visit us at the library. And if you drop me an email and let me know you're coming, I'll be more than happy to give you a behind-the-scenes tour for all your listeners.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for your time, David, and I'm sorry that I'm going in and out. But
that's okay, Susan. I would be delighted to be your guest any time at all. You let me know if in the future I can chat with you on any subject of genealogy. It would be a complete pleasure.
I would love to have you back.
All right.
And thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Susan. Have a great day. Thank you.
Uh-huh. You too.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.